reviewing samples and looking that the financial audit represents the financial situation of the company all over. We in forensics, we always build our analysis that the situation is always different. We have a lot of instruments, and then we see good, what's the question and how we can investigate this and analyze it. And we're not analyzing the whole financial statement, but maybe just a certain category of assets. So going very deep, very in detail, and maybe just one project out of a very big company. And that's the difference to our financial audit guys. They have to sign at the end the financial statement of the company. So the financial statement, the results represent how the company looks like for a certain date. And we have always a different engagement at the different scope, but going very into detail. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Patrick Goschle from PwC Vienna, Austria, and we're going to talk about a topic that no finance professional can ignore, and that's fraud. And how to make sure it doesn't get you fired. Because it doesn't matter whether you are culpable or not. If you're sitting on the finance team, basically you had one job, and that was to look after the money. But fraud is something which is surprisingly common and often not properly addressed in all sorts of organizations and all types. So today we're going to talk with Patrick about his experience working in the most exciting job in finance, as far as I can figure out, which is the forensic services department at PwC. Patrick, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. Maybe you could just tell the listeners a little bit about you and your background and your experience.
Working nearly 15 years in forensics, fighting fraud. I started a business administration, started in the accounting department, and then I switched to a small consultancy in Austria where my boss was an expert witness, and he did expert witness reports to the prosecutors for the courts and so on. And so I jumped into this forensics topic. If I'm at a garden party and somebody asks me what I'm doing and I'm saying forensics, everybody thinks about, well, I'm doing something with dead bodies and so on, if somebody was murdered. But I'm doing that, but I'm doing this to maybe dead companies, but also companies which are still live, they open that, look into the numbers, look into the data, look into the documents and see what has happened and why maybe the company is a bit ill. Means that some kind of fraud happened there. Was working in this company for about 7-8 years and then I switched to PwC, working on fraud cases in Austria, CE internationally. And that's quite an interesting topic. Not every fraud is different. And so there's a different cases to solve.
So let's talk about this topic from the basics. Let's assume nothing and start off with what is fraud? Like technically, what's the technical definition of fraud? I guess we all have it in our mind, but is there something specific when it comes to accountancy?
Technically, the definition, if you ask some of your friends or your relatives, maybe it's somebody experienced in some company that somebody just took money out of the cashier. And to make it a bit more formal structured, we have a global organization. It's the ACFV, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. So it's based in the US, but it's all over the world. There are members. You're doing also certifications, and they have a certain structure. They structured it. It's called the fraud tree, and they have three main parts of fraud. One is corruption. The second one is asset misappropriation, means theft of goods, theft of money, so on. And a third part, which is often, if there are big scandals or so on, when you look back the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's financial statement fraud. So these are the three overall categories that they made. Of course, there are a lot of different categories. I think I will not go into detail, but just to have a first impression what different frauds can occur. And of course, in a lot of cases, it's not just one fraud, but there is, for example, asset misappropriation connected with financial statement fraud to hide something. And in this area, we are working.
You just reminded me there, I was speaking with a CFO last week and he was recounting his first ever job where his boss got fired and he had to present the accounts to the board. And he went up and produced some accounts which didn't look so good. And the CEO grabbed him by the shirt and pulled him across the table saying, these figures better be better on Monday morning. And then he was left to deal with it, you know. So it was kind of shocking, but I guess it happened. So bringing to that question, how common is fraud? I mean, we don't like to think of this happening, but how often does it happen?
If I do one step back, when we work in a company, we can lower their risk having fraud to zero. But then we have to just stop working. That's also not an option. So we have to see how we can lower the risk of fraud. There are several studies. Also, the ACFE is doing every 2 years a study. We from PwC also doing global studies. Yeah? And what is all together when we look so about last 24 years and then ask companies, have you experienced fraud? They were in the last studies, they were always between 40, 48, 49%. So it means nearly 50% of the companies in an average suffered a fraud case. Can be a very small one, say after 100 euros, or can be a really big one, means a big corruption topic. But if you are maybe a small, medium-sized company, and also a bigger one, there will be fraud cases if you have a certain size, a certain number of employees. So the thing is, you have to prepare for it, you have to deal with it, and you have to raise your awareness that such things can happen. There are not just good persons out there, but they can also be bad persons, or also persons which are originally not bad, but they come in a certain situation and then some pressure coming from different sides can appear that a person which is normally not committing fraud is doing fraud in a certain situation.
And I can imagine, like, you know, even sometimes it's a very awkward position if you're on the finance team. Let's say I can empathize most with small businesses where, let's face it, you know, the simple expense claiming for small businesses where people are saying, well, I'm taking a taxi, you know, well, that it was to pick their kid up from school or whatever. But you go from something like that, which people don't really think about, all the way up to dragging your finance director across the boardroom table, telling him to change the numbers for Monday. So basically what you're saying there is there's no immunity from this, no matter whether you're on a finance team with a 10 or a 1,000 people company. It happens everywhere.
For example, just talked to a colleague some days ago, and his father had a pizzeria, was sending pizzas, and they had waiters and so on, maybe just 3 or 4 or 5 employees. And one of the employees, he was a very good employee, doing a good job, but he was taking money out of it. And so it means you can be a large corporate in different countries, or you can be a small bar, small restaurant, doesn't matter. Of course, you have different kinds of risks depending on the business you're doing, depending on the industry you're in. But there is, most of the time, there is some kind of a risk.
Well, that's a good point. Let's jump into a model, a couple of models to think about this. So yeah, one is something called the fraud triangle. So what is that?
The fraud triangle, there was a guy called Kurt Gressin in the 70s, and he did research what circumstances have to occur that the possibility of a fraud is getting higher. He defined three things, and the fraud triangle is one of the most common explanations in the literature and studies, in books and so on. The first one is there is the opportunity. Means if you have cash in the company somewhere and you have a company of 50 employees and everybody can go to this room where the cash is, open this cupboard and take the cash out, there is an opportunity that everybody can go there. If there is no need that everybody has to go to this room and take the cash out, but maybe just 5 persons, and you give them a key that just 5 persons can reach the money, you lower the opportunity, a risk that somebody can take the cash. So that's the first topic. Then I said before that I mentioned that the word pressure means that, okay, maybe got to get back, just that there is an opportunity, not everybody will take out the cash. But then there's the pressure, means if you are, for example, a couple, you bought a house, you have a mortgage at the bank, and one of this couple is getting maybe ill, earning not that money anymore, you have to pay, make your payments to the bank, you're not able to make the payments because you're ill, then you have a certain pressure is appearing that you look for how you can get a bit more money. And if you then work to the company, seeing this room that there is some cash lying around in a simple example, yeah, there is a bit more pressure that you take this money to just solve your private problems. Means not everybody will do it, but the majority is bigger. And then there's a certain dimension means the rationalization. What does this mean? It means that the individual thinks about this. The person thinks, should I do this? Should I do this not? What does happen when I do it? Is this a good thing? Always a good. I expect that persons are good persons. Yeah? And then the thing is, can they explain to themselves that the thing that they're doing is okay? For example, if you had an opinion last year, I expected to get a pay rise and my boss gave me just 2% and I expected 5%, or I wasn't getting a certain job in the company, or the boss is not paying to me additional hours I worked up. Just a topic why the person says it's fine to them doing it. And if it's just, I'm just borrowing the money for 3 months and then I will give it back, can also be a rationalization. Yeah?
Sure.
And this is then the thing, this is the fraud triangle, and you can see it when you think about your mathematical lessons in school. There was an equation and the result is the fraud risk. And it's always you have the pressure times the rationalization times the opportunity. And if just one of them is 0.01, it's rather small. And if the things are getting better and they are multiplied, the risk is getting higher. Whereas there also, besides the fraud triangle, as I said, it's the most common model thing, how you can explain a fraud risk, how this can occur. There are also other models, kind of like the fraud diamond. Yeah? What additional topics are there in? There's, for example, the capability. As I say, just going into a room, open a cupboard, take out the money is a rather easy thing to do. Everybody of us can do it if we have two hands and fingers and so on. Yeah? But if you look into bigger corporates, we know nothing is running in business now without computers and IT systems and ERP systems like SAP and so on, accounting systems, the things get a bit more complicated. And in this fraud diamond, there was a further dimension added. It means the capability. If the person has the intellect and is technically able to commit this fraud, because if you want to do fake invoices to get some certain approvals and an ERP system for payments, it's getting quite more complicated, and you need to have a certain kind of intelligence and intellect and technical skills to organize this for you.
That reminds me of like one of the biggest costs of sort of a hidden cost here is if you don't have procedures in place, I'm going to talk about some of those at the end of the podcast, you're basically putting your staff at risk. So ordinarily, James is a good guy. He's not going to do anything wrong, but given the wrong set of circumstances, you know, you don't want to put them in a situation where they can possibly make a mistake. And a big cost that people don't think about is if you discover fraud in the organization, there's a lot of organizations, there's no choice but to move that employee along. And that's a massive cost. Could be an excellent employee providing great value to the company and the customers and everyone. But like in a lot of situations, you just won't have a choice. So if you're not protecting your staff from these opportunities, then you're actually doing them a disservice. And that sounds a little bit controversial to say, but that brings us on to this framework, which is the 10-80-10 framework. Maybe you could explain that for us. And do you think it's a useful way to look at, you know, the opportunities in a company and how people react?
Well, I've heard about this rule about this 10-80-10, and I've not done research about this, but just from a practical experience, I say yes, this is maybe if 10-80-10 or 8-85-5 is on the up, it's not a thing. But I think there are really persons who would never do something, yeah, who really could secure, and I think there must be a really high pressure or so on that they will commit fraud. Then there is, I think, the large proportion who under normal circumstances will not do something. Yeah. Sometimes people ask, good, what is your price? Is it 1 million, 5 million, 10 million, 100 million? What is your price to do something which is not okay? And if you have this 80%, I guess that beginning from some certain sum of millions or so on, yeah, maybe some person more committed to do something, yeah. And then there is, of course, also a certain group, yeah, which is for example, maybe actively looking for possibilities to do things, or maybe more from the personality, more open to do it. I don't know the certain numbers, but this rule or this model seems good to me. Seems like a good idea to explain it, to categorize as the different kind of persons you have out there.
And both of these models might be useful in terms of getting buy-in for improved controls. Inherently, you know, when you have to explain to people, basically, you're kind of inherently you're saying, listen, I think your potential to be a fraudster. That's why I'm putting these controls in place. That's a difficult pill to swallow. But if you put these frameworks, it's a rule, the 10-80-10 rule. So it must be true, I guess. So you can kind of talk about it and say, well, listen, that largely makes sense. I mean, all of us have told a white lie at some stage, or maybe 90% of us. Mm. I'm definitely in the 80% at least. And then it's a little bit easier in terms of change management then when you have to help people understand why more controls are necessary. And let's face it, you know, finance teams have a reputation for red tape, and you don't want to add anything that's going to be, you know, unnecessary, but actually this is very necessary in a lot of cases. We've talked a little bit about some of the frameworks you can think about here and more generally kind of academic in a perspective, but you know, I've had a lot of experience maybe dealing actually with fraudsters. I guess you've met many fraudsters, which is a weird concept. But what is your experience of the life of a fraudster? What it is like for them? Would you say, can you spot them on the street now? What is it like? How many fraudsters have you interviewed at this stage?
I don't know. That's quite a lot. Some months ago, I thought about with a colleague how many interviews I did. Well, I'm not just interviewing fraudsters, but also the guys around. And I guess I don't know if it will be 1,000 interviews, but several hundred it would have been. What's life of a fraudster? I also asked some time ago, ChatGPT, can you, the picture creator of ChatGPT, can you make me a picture of an Austrian fraudster? And I tried it several times, and ChatGPT always made a person, and it was always a male person, the fraudster. Well, it's always that the same picture occurs when you look into different studies. Means so when I look back the last 10, 15 years, it's most of the cases, so two-thirds or 75% plus minus, etc., are the fraudsters male. And the lower proportion is female in this area. And this is also my personal impression when I look back the last 15 years. The majority was male, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then but there were also some female accountants, yeah, who transferred millions of euros to their own bank account and so on. And coming to the other thing, what is this to be a fraudster? I had a case several years ago, and there was a guy working in the bank, and he was not giving money to his bank account, but he did some things. He sold products to clients, and they lost their money, and then they were coming to him and wanted to have their payments from the bonds and so on. Yeah. And he thought from himself, yeah, he doesn't want to say them that they're worthless. These were quite elderly people, above 70 and so on, yeah, and they were not so killed about finance, yeah. And so he took money from other bank accounts, yeah. And this worked for several years. And the thing is, I think he every day when he walked into the bank, into his place, into his office where he worked, everybody must have thought, maybe today they will come, they need an audit with Amazon, and they will find me. All right. And imagine if you are such a person, you know you're doing something wrong, and there's maybe a damage of several million euros, pounds on, yeah, and you're going every day to work, every day to your desk, to your computer and so on, and every day you must have some little thought back in your brain that maybe today it could end, and they check it. And it lasted several years. Yeah? And this is just from the topic exactly. It must be some kind of stress for everybody. What does this with a person? And it's also, if you look into the personality and how they behave and how they feel, yeah, it must be a bit different. Yeah? I think, I guess, maybe there are also other persons, yeah, who are very, very in alpha males types and so on, and then to who behave others, but it's just a thing to look at this from another perspective.
We'll get into that in a second, but just to clarify that case there, so was this an asset manager for elderly, you know, how was the actual?
Yeah, he managed and said, yeah, elderly, okay, how will you have a lot of money, how to invest it and so on, yeah.
Right.
And the elderly persons were really not skilled, and he sold them things where there was a very good interest, but they were not so secure as other things. Yeah. Unfortunately, the majority of it was worthless after some time. Yeah.
So this was kind of a Wolf of Wall Street situation. You're dialing
a bit different. Yeah.
Okay.
The guy was then not taking money to himself, yeah, mm-hmm. but he was taking money from other clients and gave it to the clients who lost something, yeah.
Oh, straight up Ponzi scheme then.
So we did an investigation, and the majority was at the end the result that he was not taking money and buying boats and houses and so on. But it's just, for example, if you live in a smaller town, everybody knows you, you're in the football club, you're in other clubs, and you have a certain renommee as a person, yeah? Mm. Everybody knows you, and then maybe you did something wrong and everybody will know in your social group,
yeah,
that you did something wrong. That's also kind of a pressure, a stress for you, and that is what I meant with the fraud triangle, yeah?
Yeah.
It was the opportunity, okay, and then there was the pressure that he had to do something. And of course, it also the rationalization, not it was it exactly, but I think it was rationalization. I will give these clients their money back.
Interesting. So I wonder if that started off many years before. Does it build up? Do people start with smaller amounts and then grow and grow and grow?
Saw it in several times that they're starting small, yeah. And the interesting thing is, if they would still doing small things, maybe nobody would have seen it, yeah.
Right.
But then they're getting more secure, and it works that nobody sees it and so on, and maybe the processes or so on are not as good as they should be in this kind of company, and then taking bigger sums, making bigger fake invoices, for example, and so on. After a certain time, it gets too big, or maybe a new colleague is coming, or an intern audit is coming, or so on, or something happens. This is also when fraud occurs, and you find one in invoice at the beginning. You don't know at the beginning, is this the only was? I have been there 10, 15, 20, 100 before. And this is also when we're doing investigations, one of the questions we ask, was this the only thing? Was that just a damage of maybe 5,000 euros? Or did the person do this several times before and the damage is quite bigger?
Right. Okay. What's the difference between like a standard audit and a forensic audit when there's, I guess, a standard audit, there's no assumption anything's wrong?
That this is the intention when you do a normal financial audit. Yeah. Our colleagues also in auditing, they're looking at the certain high level, they're reviewing samples and looking that the financial audit represents the financial situation of the company. Mm. All over. We in forensics, we always build our analysis that the situation is always different. And so we have a lot of instruments. And then we see, good, what's the question and how we can investigate this and analyze it. And we're not analyzing the whole financial statement, but maybe just a certain category of assets. So going very deep, very in detail, and maybe just one project out of a very big company. And that's the difference to our financial audit guys. They have to sign at the end the financial statement of the company, so that the financial statement, the results represent how the company looks like for a certain date. And we have always a different engagement at the different scope, but going very into detail, yeah, into it.
So what are the skills that, like, if you wanted to get into this idea of forensics, like, what sort of personality type does suit to? Is it just analytical, or what sort of team do you need to really do a proper investigation?
Well, I'm in my investigation team. I'm leading the investigation team in the forensic service department. I have colleagues who studied business administration, I have guys who studied law, but we are not doing legal services. We're not giving legal advice, but we're working together with lawyers and so on. I have also a former journalist in my team. And since last year, I have also a former military officer, because in my area is also that the kind of means a crisis management, means every, if there are fraud case occurs, is always a crisis. So we also offering a crisis management services to our clients. We employed a former office and the Austrian army.
So you can provide the investigation and the execution in one service.
And we also have in our department, we also have an IT team, yeah? Means we also securing, analyzing all kind of emails, documents, all electronical data. Structured electronical data means data from the accounting system, ERP systems, everything which is in a certain structure in companies, and also unstructured data besides email and WhatsApp and communication, also all kind of Excel, Word documents, PowerPoint files, everything which is electronically available in the company, and doing them some kind of an e-discovery. And we have a lot of data, and we're making out of the data, we are transforming it to information. For example, if you see a large Excel file with a lot of columns and a lot of tabs and so on, and you have one look at it, you don't know what's in there. But if you make, for example, a diagram out of it, a graph or a pivot table, you can aggregate the information, and then you have a better idea what's in the data. And this is what I mean. We're transferring the data to information, and we connect the different information means from the accounting department, from emails, maybe doing background research, looking at the bank transactions, and also we're doing also a lot of interviews. And then we have to find out so what comes out at the end, because our deliverable at the end is, for example, a report which goes to the legal department, to the CEO, to the supervisory board. And based on this report, then the decisions for handling this case in the next steps are made. And often the cases, also our report goes to the lawyers, and the lawyers say, good, these facts have to be interpreted in a legal way in this and this way. Yeah.
And how often does a investigation go to law, so to speak? How often would it be handled internally versus, you know, is there a certain line where there's no choice, you have to go to the authorities?
Looking back the last 7-8 years, it was the minority when such things really went to court. Yeah, it's over with the topic. If maybe a lot of things are not white and black, but different shades of gray, also depending in some cases in times of labor law and so on. Yeah, well, what you can do with which contract is there, what's possible. And companies often say, okay, good, we'll dismiss this guy or find a certain solution that is not working anymore in this company because there was a loss of trust. Yeah? The things are in the practical situation not every time as easy and as simple as it seems.
Yeah.
So if it's a dark gray but not black, there are often some insecurities. And that is just my personal experience that the minority of these things is really going to court. Sometimes it is, of course. And as I'm working in my previous company for the prosecutors and at the court, yeah, there were all the cases at the court. Yeah, so there's also quite a lot of work to do for the public officials.
I'll ask you one more question about, you know, what it's like to work in this field, and then we'll move on to some strategies for prevention. But in that moment of truth, when someone realizes the game is up, realizing that they've been caught, what is the reaction? Is it different for every person, or is it a relief? What's it like to be in that room when they realize the game is up?
Some say at the beginning, okay, I've done it. I'm sorry. I was waiting for it. Yeah, depends on the personality. Depends also somehow on the level of the person. Is it an ordinary person in the accounting department? Is it a medium management, or is it a top management? Some person maybe try to explain these things. Yeah? When I go back to this case in the bank, yeah, there were things that in these years when this happened, there was one time some internal audit guys asked him, yeah, what's this and this? And said, oh, it were wrong bookings. I will correct it.
Right.
And then it was going on for 2 or 3 or 30 years, yeah?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I can only imagine what it's like. It must be so very stressful situation, awkward management situation, to say the least. Let's wrap up here with some, what steps should you take to mitigate the risk here? Really, is it your job to mitigate the risk? So what are the best ways to do that?
To mitigate the risk is beginning doing a risk assessment. What is your business? What is your industry? And how you can address the 2-3 top risks. I think that is the most important things.
And this risk assessment, is this something that you should reach out to a specialist for? Or is it something you can put into ChatGPT? Or...
You can ask a specialist, but I think you and your business, you are also the expert in this. And just sit down, take a piece of paper, take a pen, yeah? And then you can just try it a bit. Yeah, I think that doesn't take that much money. You have to don't make it very complicated. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's so the topic that you can really do it rather basic, and it will help you.
And I guess this is something you could do annually. Is that it, that you would bring to board, or is it just a document that sits, you know, ready for the day? Or
yeah, I think you have to do it periodically. It's a really, really good thing. Yeah, if something changed. Yeah.
And I suppose to talk my own book a little bit, having four eyes in every purchase is what we do at Procurement Express. Like if you're a bigger company, you might use SAP or Ariba or other platforms. And if you're in a medium-sized company, you just want to make sure that there's no one person involved in every purchase, which is kind of an obvious thing, you know. So whoever is taking delivery should be different from the person authorizing the spend and the budget and the one who's actually making the payment. Kind of straightforward, but sometimes you might be tempting just to short step that. And I feel like even if you do that, even with something like purchasing in your company, it sets a culture of like, okay, we sweat the small stuff, like you dot the I's across the T's, and that's less likely than you're going to be, people feel like there's a, we came to this opportunity, talk about opportunity. It's like, well, if you take the management of the expenses and the purchasing correctly, then it's less likely that people feel like there's an opportunity to do anything else, and even if it's not to do with purchasing. So I had to do my own advertisement there. Sorry, in this topic, it's so close to what we do that, you know, and if anyone's listened to this before, you'll know that we started the business on the back of a fraud that was happening in a cosmetics business in Ireland. The MD, he got 3 years in prison and we got a software business out of it. So it happens all the time. And the other thing we didn't touch on as well is reputational risk. There's even the perception, especially actually company like PwC, I mean, very large consultancy brands have been brought down. We think of Enron, I guess, famously their auditor was it Arthur Andersen?
Arthur Andersen, yeah, they were the big five, yeah.
And
it's always when, okay, you can suffer some kind of money loss, yeah, that's the one thing, yeah. But the reputational loss is by far in a lot of cases quite bigger.
Yeah.
Which you can have, and it's not just a question of losing money, but also of losing reputation. And the thing is also, if there's some rumors and it makes it to the newspaper page number one in a company-wide newspaper, and even at the end, everybody says, okay, nothing happens, there is still the bad news on it, and you cannot delete it. Yeah? And that's really also really a crisis communication topic, which you have to take care of. This, if you are a bigger company, not a small one, and if we have maybe a communication department, just prepare how you would react in such a certain case, or maybe look for specialized agencies who know how to deal with such topics.
Sure. I mean, the nonprofit sector jumps out there. Basically, all you have is your brand. If you're in a nonprofit and you're fundraising, and if there's any aspersion on how you're doing that, then instant death for that organization. I've seen it happen in Ireland, certainly with certain charities that there's been alleged impropriety, and that's it, charity goes. That's it, you're not going to give money. And which speaks to reputation, which brings me to my last question, because I think it's relevant, which is, who's your business hero? And you've got someone with quite a reputation behind him.
My business hero is Warren Buffett, because he's so successful since decades. And he said a very good sentence some years ago, which was decided that it takes 20 years to build your reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. If you think about that, you'll do things differently. And the thing we very often said, and I also printed out this guy, I think it's a really, really, really good one, and he is very successful in business, but also knows how to do it in a good way, and also that you have to look at your reputation and doing business in a fair way.
I was listening to a podcast last night where they discussed Warren, and he has a reputation for buy and hold, you know, never sell. But it's not actually true. If you look at his, you know, Berkshire, they sell all the time. It's just what he has this reputation for it. And it doesn't really matter now, because what you're known for, I guess, is the important thing. And you just got to make sure you think about what you're going to be known for. Patrick, this has been super interesting. I could talk to you for another hour about this. So, you know, we've talked about risk assessments. We've talked about any sort of size of business, I guess, has to think about this. Who would be sort of a typical client that you would deal with, and how could they get in touch with you?
The big client would be where we're working with all kind of companies, the most medium-sized companies to big groups, corporations. If you want to reach me, best reach out to me over LinkedIn, yeah, and then we can talk how we can help you.
Great. Okay. Well, I can just about see the beautiful Vienna beside you there behind you. So I'll let you get back to your day. We can both go and do some real work, I guess. If you listen to the podcast this far in, thank you very much. First of all, you can sign up for our newsletter at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. If you're an expert in an area like Patrick is related to the finance function, I would love to talk to you, get you on here and go deep on a topic. We can go as nerdy as you want here when it comes to finance. And until the next one, we'll see you then. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Thank you. Well, it was a pleasure. Bye.